And they ended up taking over the Jaguar contract for IMSA in 1988. So 87 was the last year that the Group 44 Tullius team ran the Jaguars in IMSA. But by then, you got to remember that there were sort of the third generation of GTC cars were emerging with the Nissan, and the Porsche 962 was getting a little long in the tooth. You know, Corvette GTP, the Chevy was planning in, their Intrepid. Toyota was dabbling in the series by then, and the writing was on the wall that the Tullius Jaguars were going to become obsolete and uncompetitive with the new cars. So that might have had something to do with it as well.
But it was a factory decision.
It was a factory decision. It had nothing to do with you know, anything else, I believe.
Not good guys and bad guys. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah,
anybody
I think it's
out
important
there?
That...
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm just asking if anyone out there had a question for you.
Yeah, I think it's important at this point to also cover the Camel Lights cars, which were that whole genre was really started by Jim Downing. You know, Jim was a factory Mazda guy forever and ever and had success in the RS series. He won the GTU championship. And he was given the choice of running a three-rotor GTO car, you know, the RX-7 GTO, or developing a prototype car to run in GTP. And he chose to do the latter and ended up taking an Argo chassis with a Mazda rotary engine in it and running that in 84. And, of course, the car was underpowered and uncompetitive at the front end of the grid. So he approached my dad in the middle of 1984 and with the idea of creating a separate class for lower displacement cars, normally aspirated, no turbos, with readily available chassis and engine combinations. And that came to pass in 85 with the Camel Lights class. In fact, the name Camel Lights came from Jim Downey's mechanic who smoked Camel Lights and suggested that that might be a good name for the series. So that's how the name came about.
Yeah, I don't know who that was.
But the Camel Lights class was important because as GTP racing became more and more expensive and drove out some of the smaller teams and the factories came in full bore, the Camel Lights cars started to fill up the field with more and more entries. And that was important for a lot of reasons. We were running races on TV by this point. They looked good. They sounded good. They were competitive. And it allowed the fans to focus on a race within a race. And at many times in the late 80s, the prototypes ran on their own because there were so many GTO and GTU cars, they would have their own races. And so Downing was very clever because he had a whole season to sort out his car and ended up winning the championship the next 3 years, the Camel Lights Championship. But we had other cars show up with Buick motors, with Chevy engines, and, you know, eventually other chassis manufacturers like Spice came into the series. Fab Car built a sort of 962 light, which used actually the same windshield as the 962, but everything else about it was different. And I think that the engine displacement was limited to 3 liters. I could be wrong about that, but the class became super important to the success of IMSA moving forward and helped us, you know, fill up the field. But, you know, in the middle of the 80s, starting with 85, 86, 87, when Al Hulbert won the championship in his 962, The 962 really just dominated the series. It became the ultimate customer car because anybody could go buy one if you had enough money. And Porsche did its usual fantastic job of delivering a car off the factory line that was race-ready and competitive, but also supporting the teams with parts and service at all the events. And this was, you know, again, the theme of IMSA was enabling private competitors like the Aikens and the Dysons, you know, and the Levins and so on to be competitive at the front end of the grid. And they could do it by buying a factory car. They could do it by building their own car. But through the middle of the 80s, the 962 was really the story. And by then, you know, IMSA had expanded its schedule to include not just permanent road courses, but also street circuits and ovals with infields. You know, we ran races at Miami, Columbus, Del Mar, many other street circuits. And it became, you know, through the middle and end of the 80s, IMSA became really the premier sports car racing series on the planet because it was way more diverse in terms of entries. It was way more diverse in terms of the tracks that we ran on. And to win the championship, you had to be great at all of them. It wasn't just, you know, pure speed on long wheelbase tracks like Spa and Le Mans. Our GTO and GTO classes were huge. As I mentioned, we started running races just for them. They became support races. Obviously, at Sebring and Daytona and the longer races, they ran with the prototypes. But any of the photos that you see from back in the day and now the TV coverage, it was crazy in terms of the amount of diversity in the field. And the factories were supporting it. You know, Chevy with a Corvette GTP. Nissan showed up in 1985 for the very first time at Riverside with the Electromotive team run by Don Diefendorf. That car took 3 years to develop, and it started to get faster and faster. And by, you know, 88 through 91, it won the championship, you know, hands down. But other factories came in too, like BMW with their March 86G, which David Hobbs drove with other folks like John Andretti, Davy Jones, I think was another driver. They did win one race at Watkins Glen that year in 87, but true to form with BMW, they came in for a year full bore, and then they decided to quit IMSA and focus on Formula One. And the cars were sold. They didn't do as well. They never really showed their promise, but I think David would tell you even today that it was the fastest GTP or prototype car that he's ever driven. He thought that with some development, it could have been another Nissan.
How about the Toyota?
Yeah, the Toyota started to show up in the hands of the All-American team, the Dan Gurney team, in 88, I believe, certainly in 89. And it took them a couple years to learn what would be competitive in IMSA. And their initial car was a sort of a third generation car to compete with Nissan. But they also showed up with the beginnings of the fourth generation GTP car, which was ultimately what would dominate the championship in 92 and 93. And it took some development to develop the cars. And what the teams were starting to figure out was that small displacement, high revving, turbocharged motors were the way to go. Reduce the weight. Once they figured out how to mitigate turbo lag, the cars were incredibly fast and much easier and more predictable to drive. We saw that with the Nissans, and Toyota carried on that idea with their sort of fourth generation GTP car in 91, 92, and 93. Yeah. So the BMW, by the way, that when BMW got out, Moretti bought a couple of the chassis, I think, and installed Buick engines for the 87 season.
His team had a lot of different cars.
Yeah, and you know, by the time the 88 and 89 seasons came around, the 962 was still competitive, obviously. We lost Bob Hulbert, I think, at the end of the 88. Sorry, Al Hulbert at the end of the 88 season, but his team ended up doing quite well with the 962 in 87, obviously winning the championship. But their primary competitor that year were the Jaguars. But if you look at the field, you know, you had two Toyotas in there as well, and you had the Nissans who were coming on strong. So you really weren't quite sure who was going to win the races, which is how you want it. And the racing was close, and the fans loved it. And by then, a lot of the IMSA races were on TV, covered live. And TV really changed the game quite a bit for everybody, changed it for our sponsors and the promoters, but it really made IMSA more of a household name than it was before. So I guess I'll open it up to questions at that point, because the next topic I want to talk about is how and why did IMSA get sold? And so before we get into that, I'll just open it up to any other questions.
Not crickets. Come on, folks.
We got crickets.
We got crickets.
I think I put them to sleep.
No, not hardly.
And by the way, if anybody wants to get more details on all this stuff, it's in the book I co-authored with Mark Rafoff called IMSA 1969 to 1989. It's available on Amazon, and I think you can actually get it cheaper at the publisher site, octanepress.com. But we cover all these topics in a lot of detail and a lot of behind-the-scenes stories. But
it weighs 14 pounds and is full of stuff, tons of pictures. It's my favorite book in all the world.
370 photos, so 2.5 years to write. And I was so happy to be done with that thing because it came out great.
Are you doing another one?
We are in the process of beginning to the next chapter, which would be 1990 to 1999. And that's
great.
A good segue into how and why IMSA was sold. As everybody knows, my parents started IMSA in 1969. And I think really the first seminal moment in the sale of IMSA was December of 1987, when my dad went in for his pilot license physical. He was a private pilot. And every year you had to go in and get your physical. And he went in for his physical, thought nothing of it. They made him take a stress test. He flunked the stress test so bad that they called an ambulance and drove him to the hospital. And the next day he had quadruple bypass surgery. And so that was a wake-up call. You know, seeing my dad in the hospital a day later, we flew out from California, was a wake-up call. And it made me realize, and it made them realize, how hard they've been working over the last, 18 years to build IMSA into this powerhouse. So 1988 was the first year that my parents didn't go to all the IMSA races. By then, they had installed a great team of folks that could run the races without them. And that was another aha moment for them, that they realized that it wasn't going to fall apart without them. In the middle of 88, Ralph Sanchez, as I mentioned, the promoter of the Miami Grand Prix, approached them with the idea of buying IMSA. And it was really the first time that that had happened. And there was news articles about it in Autoweek Competition Press, which really, I don't know how they got a hold of the news, but my father ended up turning the offer down because they couldn't agree on price. But the news articles prompted other folks to approach, like Rob Dyson and Bob Aiken, who approached my father and said, hey, before you sell this thing to Sanchez, let us have a crack at it. And they wanted to form a car owner kind of consortium, not dissimilar to CART in IndyCar. And my dad didn't really like that idea. He thought that the idea of the competitors owning the series was ultimately going to fail, and did fail when you look at CART.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea was put out there, and it was put out there in a public way. And later that year, they were approached by a couple of guys named Mike Cohn and Jeff Parker, and they wanted to put on a one-off race in Tampa. They wanted to put on a sort of IMSA GTP versus FIA Group C challenge race, and they called it the GTE World Challenge of Tampa, and they actually did put the race on in November of 88. But in meeting Jeff and Mike, and they got to talking. By the way, Camel Cigarettes wanted nothing to do with yet another race in Florida, so it was not a Camel-sponsored event. And it was lightly attended. I think they only had like 11 or 12 entries. But the race did happen. Mike was a developer in the Tampa area and a general contractor, big development project. And his advisors, Kelly, I forgot his name now, but advised him to, hey, I hear that IMSA's for sale. Why don't you try and buy IMSA? So one thing led to another. They agreed on a price and terms, and IMSA was sold to Mike Cohn and Jeff Parker, and that deal was finalized in February of 89. So IMSA officially changed hands in February of 89, but it was announced prior to the Del Mar race at the end of the 88 season. The headquarters for IMSA moved from Bridgeport, Connecticut to Tampa. The staff were given a choice. They could move to Tampa or you know, part ways with the company. Most of the staff decided to part ways. Mark Raffoff and George Silverman ended up moving to Tampa and becoming the president and a vice president of the new IMSA owned by Mike Cohn and Jeff Parker. And the feeling in the paddock was a little bit of an uneasiness at the start of the 89 season. But you got to remember, the series was going very strong. It was incredibly popular, and physical attendance and TV viewership were still very, very high and growing. Factory involvement was high, fields were full, and so the mood turned back to extreme positivity and optimism. In the meantime, my parents retired to an airplane community in Ocala, Florida, about 80 miles north of Orlando. And my dad started fooling around with airplanes, which he really loved. But Mike ended up about a year later buying Jeff Parker out. And then there were a few factors that happened that led to a decline. First of all, there was a global economic decline that saw manufacturers leave the series. Not the least of which was the cost of competing with Nissan and Toyota. And the other was that Mike ended up draining the resources of the company, of IMSA, which was cash positive, to fund his contracting business. And ultimately, Mike and his wife were both indicted and jailed for fraud. and I'm not sure if he's still in jail or not. I think he is. But it was a bad deal, and the other thing that happened, of course, was that Camel Cigarettes had to leave the series. They were forced to by government regulation at the end of the 93 season. So IMSA really was at a turning point, and they needed to come up with a new set of rules to attract a new set of entrants and kind of revive the show during all of this upheaval. And that's when the World Sports Car concept came to be, and they brought my dad back in to help them write the rules for WSC cars. And then you ended up with a Ferrari 333 SP, and you ended up with a Riley chassis and so on. Ultimately,
we had more time to get into that part.
Yeah, well, that's the subject of the next book. So,
well, we're going to have you on another time, and we can talk about from that period up to the present, if you like. And
yeah, so just briefly, I mean, ultimately, Mike drove the company into the ground and ended up selling it to one of the competitors, Charlie Slater, in 1994, who I think bit off a little bit more than he could chew. He ended up selling the company to Andy Evans, who was a prominent WSC competitor with his Ferrari. And Andy owned the company from 96 to 97. And then a consortium of team owners took it over starting in 97. It was briefly renamed the Professional Sports Car Racing Series. And the IMSA name actually disappeared for a couple of years.
It did.
97 through 99. And 99 was when Dr. Don Panos purchased the assets and started the American Le Mans Series. And IMSA, the name was revived, and the logo was revived, and it became the sanctioning body for the LMS Series.
Yay. Would you mind giving us a brief recap of all that you've covered for the last show?
Yeah, so in this show, we covered how the GTP rules came about, the IMSA relationship with the folks at Le Mans, and how that relationship was a super positive one until about 1982 when the Group C rules were forced down the Europeans' throat. But we covered the first GTP cars, the Del Russo Taylor Chevron, the BMW M1C, the Lola T600, how the Porsche 962 came about, and why it was different than the 956. And we talked about the expansion of IMSA into road courses, street circuits, ovals, with infields, the TV coverage coming on board, and then ultimately how IMSA was sold in 1989.
That is wonderful. Anybody have any questions? There's a quiet crowd tonight.
It is. I think they're watching the inauguration.
Maybe so.
Well, we've got about 45 people out here. One of them should say something.
People can hear. These recordings are archived on Dave Wallen's racinghistoryproject.com. That is racinghistoryproject.com. And you can keep up with what we've done and see what's coming up next. And I can tell you now, our next show is February the 3rd, and our guest will be Rick Knoop. And
oh, yeah, that'll be a fun time. Rick's a great guy.
I'm really looking forward to hearing him and talking to him, getting to know him a little better. We have a lot in common, and we exchange pictures of our dogs.
Well, I would just reach out to everybody that's on this call and just let them know that you can easily find me on Facebook if you've got follow-up questions or you want to know where to get the book or any other topic related to IMSA. I'm there on Facebook.
I highly recommend this book. Your collection of coffee table books is incomplete unless you have this one, and one that you will refer to many, many, many times, and it will be the solution to many arguments. All right.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate you having me on, Trish.
Oh, it's been fun. When would you like to come back?
Well, let's get this other book done first.
Really? Okay. That could be what, 3 months?
No, it'll be a couple of years.
Like it or not, you'll probably be back on before that.
Happy to
join.
Anybody
would like to hear him come back before then?
Things open up here.
Hello?
Yeah, I said Mitch and I will do a book signing when everything's open up again in California.
Is this Mark?
No, that was Dave Wollin.
That was Dave. I can't hear him very well, I'm afraid.